Jackets, free minds, free people. This is a production of the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. The Box. Inside. Outside. On.
Hello and welcome to the Box podcast of the Commonwealth Foundation. My name is Priya Abraham and I'm a senior policy analyst at the Commonwealth Foundation. And I oversee a project called Free to Teach, which we launched about a year ago. And it's a project to empower public school educators and inform them on the issues that are important to them. And today we have a great guest I'm very excited about, George Parker, who is the former head of the Washington Teachers Union in Washington, D.C., of the public school system there. He's a 30-year veteran math teacher, so he really knows his stuff. He is now a senior fellow with Students First, here to talk to us about his experience with the D.C. public schools, and in particular, the reforms that they instituted with evaluating teachers and how to keep the best teachers in our classroom. So, George, it's great to have you. Thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I just wanted to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into teaching and why D.C. City Schools? And then how did you end up head of your union?
Wow, that's a lot. Actually, you know, when I attended college, I had never planned to go into teaching. You know, when I graduated from college, you know, I wanted to be a rock star. I got into music. I actually got into teaching because when I had some dry spells, as I call them, during the music career, I did substitute teaching. And as I did substitute teaching, I began to kind of say to myself, you know, you're pretty good at this and that you kind of like it. And so when the short music career was over, I decided I wanted to teach. And so that's how I got into teaching. And I'm a 30-year teacher. I'm still certified. I grew up in North Carolina. And I learned at a very early age how valuable an education is, because I grew up very poor. And during that time, that education was really my only way out, which is very similar to what it is now for a lot of kids who are locked into failing schools, especially in urban districts like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and other places in Pennsylvania. As I became a mathematics teacher, I was always interested in workers' rights. And I think it came out of my participation in the civil rights movement in the 60s. And so even as my first year as a teacher, I was a union representative. So I had been very active in the union quite a while. And eventually I ran for office and I won election in 2005, right after we had gone through a very traumatic experience with the Washington Teachers Union, the previous president, if you remember it. But it was big news at that time when the former president, Barbara Bullock, had stolen roughly $5 million from the union. Mm-hmm. So I came in, and then at that point, and I can tell you, I was a typical union leader at first. I came in a year or two before Michelle came in. When Michelle came in, she came in with the reform person, and I was at first very resistant because I was a typical union leader. But I eventually...
Michelle Rhee is the superintendent at the time.
She was the chancellor at that time. Mm-hmm. She came in, and she was very reform-minded. So I was really resistant at first, but I eventually got it. And it was a very interesting story how I got it. I was at a school one day speaking to a group of elementary kids. I think it was like a third grade, maybe second, but I think third. And so they, you know, obviously would ask, you know, what do you do as a union president? And I said to them that I make sure that your teachers have the kind of resources and the kind of profession development and training so that they can do a great job for you. And that also makes sure that you have the best teachers. And when it was over and I was getting ready to leave, this little girl just came up and hugged me, which was kind of a surprise, right? And so, of course, I asked her, like, you know, why did you hug me? Because it was just very strange. And she said, because you said you care about us and that you make sure we get the best teachers. And then when I was driving back to the office, Oprah calls it these aha moments. I had an aha moment, and I said to myself, you know, you lied to that little girl, that you really don't care whether or not she has the best teachers, because you just spent $10,000 in arbitration to put a teacher that you know was a bad teacher back into the classroom. And I had that aha moment, and from that point, I had to begin to examine myself to to really say, are you really about kids, or are you simply just saying that you were about kids? Because that little girl brought home a certain innocence that it's like, this kid really believed what you said.
Mm-hmm.
That you make sure she has the best teachers, but in reality, as a union leader, I had just won an arbitration that put a teacher that I knew was a bad teacher back in the classroom, a teacher that I wouldn't let get anywhere near my granddaughter, but yet I would allow the teacher to go back and teach someone else's kids. So I had to have a reexamination of me and my values, and I came out and just said, look, the bottom line is, in decision-making, and it's the same thing as a union president that I think other union presidents are grappling with today, and that is, we like to say that we are about children, but in actuality, when it comes down to making decisions that are positive toward adults versus decisions that are positive toward kids, when we have to choose, we choose adults. And so I decided that I was going to make decisions that were in favor of children, and that's when I began to work with Michelle to install and implement reforms that were really geared toward children in Washington, D.C. We removed seniority from the contract as a basis for deciding whenever the system had to let teachers go.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, we were simply saying that it had nothing to do with your performance. It was just a matter of who came last. They were the ones who would go. And ultimately, that was not about putting the best teachers in front of children,
mm-hmm.
because it had nothing to do with the performance. It was all based on years of service. And so that was the first thing that I did.
And George, how was that received? Because seniority is generally seen by a lot of educators as a protection. So how did your teachers receive that?
Well, there's always a silent majority in most unions. Most vocal teachers, who were predominantly our veteran teachers, didn't go over very well.
Mm-hmm.
But the core of teachers, including the younger teachers and the great teachers, those teachers who are silent, who very seldom participate in the union, but they want the best teachers teaching along beside them. When we put it to a contract vote that had seniority removed, the contract passed by 80% of those voting, which says that the teachers actually accepted it. And then at the same time that we removed seniority, because, I mean, when you discuss it, there's not a union president. And when Michael was testifying in Harrisburg, and I noticed that when one of the committee members asked him, well, what criteria other than seniority do we use, that he always did what we as union leaders do when it comes to seniority. We ducked the question because technically as a union leader, he had the same problem I had, and that is justifying mm-hmm. how seniority actually helps children, and it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so the teachers finally agreed that, look, it's about children or it's about adults, that we have to make decisions when it comes to education. We either have to make adult-driven decisions, which is what seniority is,
mm-hmm.
or we have to make child-driven decisions, which was about performance. And too many times, the politics get in the way, and we make adult-driven decisions, and this is where most times the union is. It's about making decisions that are more adult-driven than child-driven, so that we have to do that. And so we also implemented performance pay, which I used to be against, and I was against it because pretty much as a union leader, that's one of the union things that they just teach you that is not good. But as I began to analyze it and use common sense, that it's like, yeah, I'm going for this performance pay because why shouldn't teachers who have better success, work harder, and have better results with their children, why shouldn't they get paid more? Why shouldn't they be rewarded for that? So we implemented performance pay as well. And I thought we implemented it in a very good way, and that is, all teachers had a good base salary, but the performance pay was additional to that, and it has been working very well.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of evaluation, we linked performance incentive to the teacher evaluation, and there was a new evaluation put in place. And I can tell you, that was a difficult thing to sell, that teacher evaluation, that student performance would count 50%.
Mm-hmm.
But it is working well now. It's gone down to 35%. But mm-hmm. I do believe that student performance should be a part of a teacher's evaluation because a part of teaching, there's a two-part cycle. There's the teaching and there's the learning. And that the typical observation evaluation that we're so familiar with it only judges the teaching, right? You walk into the classroom, the principal got a little chart, and they want to see if you got your bulletin boards up to date and your word walls and all of these things, and did you say certain things during the lesson, which focuses on teaching. But that's not really the end product. The end product, successful teaching, is whether or not the children learn. So I think by including student performance as a part of a teacher's evaluation, we get to the real core of whether a teacher is successful or not. And and it's going over quite well in D.C. now, that we're now seeing the fruits of that hard labor. Teachers are working harder. Those teachers who didn't want to work hard or weren't up to par, a lot of them have resigned on their own. And we're seeing the results in D.C. in the last year or so. You know, D.C. just recently, the tutor had the highest growth in the country. So I think that those reforms are kicking in now. We're beginning to see the rewards of it. But the evaluation process is one that I think is very fair. It's tough because it counts student performance as a big portion. But teachers have gotten used to it. And I think it improved teaching and the learning for students in D.C. tremendously.
Well, that's an important point, George. In Pennsylvania, due to legislation that was passed last year, we have a new teacher evaluation system that's going into effect for classroom teachers in the 2013-14 school year. And I think that there's understandably a fair amount of anxiety about how teachers wondering how they're really going to be assessed, especially with student performance being a much bigger percentage of a teacher's rating than existed before. What would you say to teachers who are moving into that kind of system, and you know, why is it a good thing?
Well, I think number one is that as a teacher, you can't say whether or not you're successful unless the children learn. Look, we grade children differently, right? We grade children by their performance. Mm-hmm. We don't grade them by how they look, how they pay attention in class. We grade them that when you have a test, or that you have to show me that you learned, and I was a math teacher, we grade you based on how well did you do on the test, and we grade students A's, B's, C's, or whatever on their performance. Well, teachers are no different. A teacher's judgment has to be based on what is your objective as a teacher. Is it to teach? Yeah, that's part of it. But what's the ultimate objective? It's to teach children, and the children learn. And so then that if you really want to judge whether or not you have an effective teacher, then you have to look at the children. Did the children learn what it was as a teacher you were attempting to teach? And if you failed in doing that, then you weren't successful regardless of how beautiful your bulletin board was, no matter how all those other superficial things that existed. The bottom line is, did the child learn it? And so I think if we really want to judge whether or not teachers are successful, we need to do what other people have done for a long time. You take sports. You don't get to play on the Philadelphia Eagles, but you don't get to play quarterback because you got the greatest number of years of service. You get to play because of your performance. And it's the same thing in terms of that. And I think that's how people want to be judged, is their performance tells the story. Now, the performance has to be, the performance rubric and the evaluation rubric has to be fair. And that what I would say to the teachers is embrace what makes common sense. And that is, are your children learning? Is really the test of whether or not you are a successful teacher. Embrace it, make sure you understand it, then grow. Embrace technology. One of the things that I used to say to my teachers, and it's in some cases I had a difficult time trying to get some of my veteran teachers to change their method of teaching, to say, okay, sure, you've been doing it for 15 or 20 years, but it's not working now because your students aren't performing well. So you got to stay abreast of the new changes. You got to stay abreast of what children are into. Children are into the technology. So I would say to the teachers, don't be afraid of the performance piece. And I'd say to the district, you have to implement it in a fair way. A good teacher doesn't mind being judged and being held accountable as long as it's fair. So that means the district needs to give the kind of professional development so that teachers have the knowledge and skill base to teach our children. They must have principals who are fair, but who are also competent, mm-hmm. who are conducting the evaluations, and giving the necessary resources for teachers to be successful. All of that has to be in place. Because I think one of the sad things that even my fellow union leaders haven't done yet is to look at a situation and say, if the kids aren't learning, you can't put it all on the school district. Mm-hmm. Because as a union president, you are part of the decision making when you sit down at the table to negotiate. And if the kids aren't learning, then you have to accept some of the responsibility for the failure that has existed. What unions have to do is embrace these changes and then gear their own professional development to help teachers be successful with this new method of evaluating.
When you implemented IMPACT, that was the name of the evaluation system in DC, it sounds like you had a pretty robust professional development component of it. I was looking at some of the statistics, and I see here that half of the teachers in 1 year who are rated minimally effective, that's the second from bottom rating, mm-hmm. within a year's time improved enough to receive an effective rating. And that's pretty impressive. How are you able to do that?
Well, I think that you start out with the philosophy that an evaluation system is not designed to fire people, that is designed to evaluate so that you as a school district knows who are the teachers who need help and in what areas. I think that when initial results came and there was a realization that a lot of the teachers did not have the skills to be successful, I think the district went to a robust professional development, but also from a union standpoint, where we also offer professional development, my professional development person actually began to have a robust piece to try to help teachers. First of all, we had some professional development to try to help teachers remove the anxiety and the fears, but also to understand the document, understand what the rubric was, and to help teachers understand how they are being evaluated, what are the indicators, and how to successfully achieve that. And saying you got to plan more, it all starts with planning. If you didn't used to plan at night, guess what? You're going to have to plan now at night. It's a reality. Mm-hmm. And so giving teachers a reality basis that, look, you can be successful at this, but at the same time, we're going to be realistic. You're going to have to work a little harder. There is no question about it. It's demanding more. If you are going to be successful, you're going to have to plan, and you're going to have to do more. Mm-hmm. And giving them that realization, I think teachers, as they began to accept that, mm-hmm. began to perform better because they realized they got to work harder, and in the end, this is what's going on.
And in DC, you ended up actually linking that evaluation to performance compensation incentives, essentially. How did that work? Can you give an example of, say, a teacher who was earning just a base salary and then got a pretty big bonus?
I got to give it to Michelle Ree. I mean, that a lot of school districts, when they go to performance bonuses, they give a little money. Like in D.C., a teacher could technically earn up to $25,000 bonus. That when you're giving bonuses, it's important. That first of all, the evaluation itself was worth the $5,000 bonus if you received and exceeds expectation. But then, if you were in a high-need subject area, like special education, mathematics, and some other areas, and you exceed expectations, you could pick up another five. Then, as an incentive for teachers to teach in low-performing schools where you had children that were at least 60 to 70% free and reduced lunch, mm-hmm. that if you achieve an exceeds expectation evaluation and you taught in one of those schools, then you could pick up another 5,000. And mm-hmm. so there were, I think, performance-related incentives that help people to improve. And it's nothing like DC holds this thing every year that's a teacher appreciation where they give the awards to teachers. And it's one of the most beautiful sights I've seen is to see those outstanding teachers walk up and receive their awards for being outstanding. And they do it every year. And I think it's wonderful. But it has been very positive in DC and teachers love it. And you see teachers who are striving to get that extra money. I mean, when you can pick up anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000, that's not chump change by no means.
Right. Right. And was that was initially instituted, was that favorably received by teachers, or was there anxiety about that too?
No, that was favorably received. Union politics, you know, came into play. Part of the grant came from the Waltons. And of course, there was some resistance in terms of, well, why are you guys going to accept money from an anti-union organization? and I had to deal with that in a union meeting, right? And I just said, I want to see the hands of every teacher who shop at Walmart's, right? And over half of the hands went up. And so I said, so now are we saying that you as a teacher can go give your money to the Waltons, but now when they want to give you some money back in a sense of performance pay, that we're not going to take it? That resistance went away very quickly.
Well, George, you've shared some great insights from your unique experience as a union leader that will help us here in Pennsylvania address the issues of seniority reform and teacher evaluations more effectively. Thanks for your time and your willingness to share what you've learned.
Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
For more information, visit studentsfirst.org to find out more about what George Parker and Michelle Rhee are trying to accomplish in terms of raising the bar in education quality for the next generation and empowering teachers to have more control over their own careers. And for more resources aimed at public school educators, visit freetoteach.org. Thanks for listening.